Imagine you are on a ship crossing the ocean. One night, a terrible storm hits, the ship breaks apart, and you find yourself washed up on a deserted island with 30 strangers. Nobody knows each other. There are no police, no courts, no mayor, no president. There is no phone signal. Nobody is coming to rescue you for a very long time. The island has fresh water, fruit trees, and wild animals you could hunt. But there is not enough of everything for everyone to take as much as they want. So what happens? Maybe at first people cooperate. They share food and help each other build shelters. But then someone stronger steals another person's food. Someone else takes the best sleeping spot by force. A fight breaks out. People start hiding what they find. They sleep with one eye open. They are afraid. The island has become a dangerous place, even though it is physically beautiful. Now ask yourself this question. What would make that island safer and fairer? Most people, after thinking about it, would say the same thing. You need some rules. You need someone to enforce those rules. You need, in other words, something like a government. This simple island story is actually a very old and important idea in philosophy. Thinkers call it the state of nature. The state of nature is an imaginary situation, a thought experiment, where human beings have no government, no laws, and no shared rules at all. Philosophers use it to ask a very deep question. If there were no government, what would life be like? And then, from the answer to that question, they try to explain why government exists and why it has the right to tell us what to do. The explanation they came up with is called the social contract. A social contract is an agreement, usually unspoken and unwritten, between the people of a society. In this agreement, each person gives up some of their complete personal freedom. In return, they receive benefits they could not get alone, such as safety, justice, and stable rules for living together. The idea is that we all accept the authority of a government because doing so makes our lives better than they would be without it. We trade some freedom for security and order. Three thinkers explored this idea more deeply than anyone else. They were Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. All three lived in Europe between roughly 1600 and 1800, a time called the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was a period in European history when thinkers began to question old ideas about kings, religion, and power, and started to use reason and evidence to build new ones. Think of it as a great awakening of critical thinking across an entire continent. These three men all used the idea of the social contract, but they came to very different conclusions. Their differences matter because their ideas directly shape real governments that exist today, including the government of the United States, the ideals of the French Revolution, and the principles behind modern democracy. Let us meet them one by one. Thomas Hobbes was born in England in 1588. He grew up and grew old during a time of terrible political violence. The event that shaped him most was the English Civil War, which lasted from 1642 to 1651. This was a brutal conflict between the king and parliament, a parliament being the group of people elected to make laws, that tore England apart. The king, Charles I, was eventually captured and executed. Towns were burned. Families were destroyed. Order collapsed in many parts of the country. Hobbes watched all of this closely, and it terrified him. In 1651, Hobbes published his most important book, called Leviathan. A leviathan is a giant sea monster from ancient stories, something immensely powerful. Hobbes chose this as a symbol for what he believed government must be. Hobbes began with a specific answer to the state of nature question. If there were no government, he said, life would be absolutely horrifying. In his view, human beings are fundamentally selfish. We all want the same things, power, resources, and safety, and there are not enough of those things for everyone. Without any authority to stop us, we would all be in constant competition and danger. He described this as a war of every man against every man. Notice he did not say occasional conflict. He said constant war, a permanent state of danger. In this world, he wrote, life would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. That phrase is one of the most famous in all of political philosophy. Write it down if you like, because it perfectly captures his dark vision. Now, Hobbes was not saying that every person is evil by nature. He was saying that even a relatively decent person, in a situation with no laws and no protection, would behave badly, out of sheer survival instinct. Think back to the island. You might not want to steal, but if you are hungry enough and there is no punishment for stealing, you might do it anyway. And even if you would not steal, you would certainly be afraid that others might steal from you. That fear alone changes how you behave. It makes you aggressive, suspicious, and defensive. So what do rational people do to escape this nightmare? They make a deal. Hobbes argued that people would come together and agree to hand over almost all of their personal freedoms to a single, all-powerful ruler, what he called the sovereign. The sovereign could be one king or a small group, but the key was that this authority would be absolute. The word absolute here means without limits. The sovereign would make laws, enforce them, judge disputes, and could not be challenged or removed. In return for this complete obedience, the sovereign would provide one essential thing: security, safety from other people, protection from the constant threat of violence. Hobbes was very clear that the people could not take back this power once they had given it away. The only exception was if the sovereign directly tried to kill you. At that point, you had the right to defend yourself, because the one reason you created the sovereign in the first place was to protect your life. So if the sovereign now threatened your life, the whole deal had fallen apart. But for any other reason, complaining about high taxes, unfair laws, unjust punishments, rebellion was unacceptable to Hobbes. Why? Because even a terrible king is better than the chaos of no king at all. The state of nature was so horrifying in his view that almost any government, however oppressive, was preferable. This is an uncomfortable idea, but it has a certain cold logic to it. Think about countries today that have experienced total collapse of government, places where wars have destroyed all central authority. In those places, ordinary people often suffer terribly, not just from the original conflict, but from the lawlessness that follows. Rival armed groups take over neighborhoods. There is no police, no courts, nobody to call if someone attacks you. Hobbes would look at such situations and say, "This is the state of nature I warned you about. Now do you understand why I said security must come first?" Now let us move to a very different thinker, a man who read Hobbes carefully and disagreed with almost everything he said. John Locke was born in England in 1632. He too lived through turbulent times, but the political event that shaped his thinking most was very different from Hobbes's Civil War. Locke was deeply influenced by the Glorious Revolution of 1688. This was a moment when King James II of England was removed from power and replaced by new rulers who agreed to respect the rights of Parliament and the people. It was called glorious because, compared to most revolutions in history, very little blood was shed. A king was replaced, power shifted, and England moved toward a more limited form of royal authority, all without the country collapsing into chaos. To Locke, this was proof of something important. It showed that you could change and limit government without everything falling apart. Hobbes's nightmare scenario did not have to come true. In 1689, Locke published his key work, Two Treatises of Government. Locke's picture of the state of nature was far more optimistic than Hobbes's. He did not see it as a war of all against all. Instead, he described it as governed by natural law. Natural law is the idea that there are moral rules that exist independently of any government, rules that human reason can discover. These rules teach us that all people are born equal and independent, and that every person possesses natural rights simply by being human. These rights are not given to you by a government. You already have them. Locke identified the three most important ones as the rights to life, liberty, and property. So in Locke's state of nature, people are generally peaceful. They understand that they should not harm each other. They live reasonably well. However, there is a problem. If someone does violate your rights, perhaps they steal your food or attack you, there is no neutral judge to settle the dispute, no reliable law everyone agrees on, and no organized power to enforce any decision. Each person has to defend their own rights, which is unreliable and can lead to escalating conflict. The state of nature is not a war, but it is inconvenient and insecure. This is why people create a government. Locke's social contract is very different from Hobbes's. It is not a desperate surrender of all freedom. It is a careful, limited deal. People agree to give up one specific power, the personal right to punish those who violate natural law. They hand this power over to a shared, neutral government. The government's job is to protect the rights that people already possess. It is like hiring a security guard. The guard does not own your house. The guard works for you. The guard can be dismissed if they fail to do their job or start threatening you themselves. This means that Locke's government is limited. It cannot do whatever it wants. It only has the powers the people gave it, and those powers exist for one purpose: to protect life, liberty, and property. Because the government works for the people, it must have the consent of the governed, meaning the people must agree, at least in general, to the system that rules them. They must have some say in who leads and what laws are made. A government that does not have this consent is not a legitimate government. Legitimate here means having a genuine right to exist and to be obeyed. And here is the most dramatic part of Locke's theory. If a government breaks the deal, if it starts violating the very rights it was created to protect, then the people have the right, even the obligation, to remove it. They can alter it or abolish it entirely. This is what Locke called the right of revolution. Locke's influence on real history is extraordinary and direct. When American colonists decided to break away from Britain in 1776, they reached for Locke's ideas to explain why. They argued that King George III had violated their natural rights, most famously by imposing taxes on them without giving them any representation in the parliament that voted for those taxes. Taxation without representation was their slogan. In other words, the British government had broken the social contract. The colonists were not starting a revolution out of greed or ambition. They were, in Locke's language, simply reclaiming rights that had always been theirs. You can see this in the Declaration of Independence itself. Thomas Jefferson wrote that all men are created equal and possess the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson changed Locke's word property to the pursuit of happiness, but the echo is unmistakable. Jefferson had been reading Locke very closely. The entire argument of the Declaration, that King George had violated these rights and therefore the people were justified in replacing the government, is pure Locke. This brings us to our third thinker, who was in some ways the most radical and the most difficult to fully understand. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was born in Geneva, Switzerland in 1712. He lived most of his adult life in France and wrote in French. He was a deeply unusual person, restless, emotional, and often in conflict with the society around him. He saw wealth, luxury, and so-called civilization not as signs of progress, but as sources of corruption and misery. He looked at the elegant royal courts and wealthy cities of 18th century Europe and saw inequality, hypocrisy, and moral decay. His most important work on government, called simply The Social Contract, was published in 1762. Rousseau had perhaps the most positive view of the state of nature among the three. He described early human beings as noble savages. These words may sound strange or even offensive today. But what Rousseau meant was that natural human beings before organized society were essentially innocent. They were free, equal, and self-sufficient. They had simple, natural desires and were capable of genuine compassion for others. They were not greedy or violent by nature. So what went wrong? Rousseau's answer is striking. Private property. When someone first enclosed a piece of land, put a fence around it, and said, "This is mine," that single act changed everything. Property created the idea that some people could have more than others. It created inequality. The more inequality there was, the more some people needed to defend what they had, and the more others resented not having it. Conflict, greed, and exploitation followed. For Rousseau, civilization as he knew it was not a solution to the problem. In many ways, it was the problem. He even argued, provocatively, that the original social contract was a kind of trick played by the rich on the poor. The wealthy people, who had property to protect, persuaded everyone to accept laws and government, presenting this as being in everyone's interest, when in fact it mainly protected the privileges of those who already had the most. Does that idea feel relevant today? But Rousseau did not want to go back to living in forests. He wanted to design a new, genuine social contract, one that would be truly fair and truly free. His solution is the most complex and also the most controversial of the three. In Rousseau's ideal contract, every single person gives up all their rights, everything, not to a king, not to a parliament, but to the whole community together. Every individual becomes part of the collective whole, because you give everything to everyone, and everyone gives everything to everyone else. You have not lost anything to a person or a group with their own interests. You have merged with the community itself. This collective community is guided by what Rousseau called the general will. The general will is not simply what most people happen to want at any given moment. It is what the whole community would want if they were thinking clearly, setting aside their personal self-interest, and focusing purely on the common good, the good of all. Imagine a town deciding whether to build a new hospital or a luxury hotel for tourists. The general will would be the hospital, because it benefits everyone, even if some individuals would personally profit more from the hotel. The general will always aims at what is genuinely best for the whole community. For Rousseau, true freedom is not doing whatever you feel like. True freedom is living under laws that you yourself, as a member of the community, helped to create. When the community creates a law through the general will, obeying that law is not submission. It is a form of self-governance. You are obeying yourself. This leads to his most controversial phrase. Rousseau wrote that anyone who refuses to obey the general will must be forced to be free. This sounds paradoxical, like a contradiction. How can you force someone to be free? Rousseau meant that when a person acts against the general will, perhaps by cheating the community for personal gain, they are actually acting against their own best interest as a member of that community. The community forcing them to comply is actually helping them live in accordance with the deeper freedom they would want if they were thinking rationally. For government, Rousseau preferred direct democracy. This means the people themselves gather to make the laws, not representatives who are elected to make laws on behalf of the people. Representatives made him deeply suspicious. He once wrote, famously, that the English people think they are free, but they are only free on election day. The moment they elect representatives, they go back to being slaves. He wanted ordinary citizens to be directly involved in making the decisions that governed their lives. Rousseau's ideas were explosively influential. When the French Revolution began in 1789, the revolutionaries who gathered in Paris spoke constantly of popular sovereignty, the idea that all legitimate power belongs to the people, and of the general will. The most radical group of revolutionaries, called the Jacobins, were particularly inspired by Rousseau. Their leader, Maximilien Robespierre, believed he was enacting the general will when he ordered the execution of thousands of people in what became known as the Reign of Terror. He believed he was purging enemies of the true will of the people. This shows how Rousseau's beautiful idea of the general will could be dangerously misused. A leader can always claim to know what the people really want, even when real people are shouting the opposite. Now step back and consider what all three thinkers were doing. They all asked the same question, why do we need government? But their answers were shaped by their times, their experiences, and their different beliefs about what human beings are really like when stripped of all social rules. Hobbes looked at civil war and concluded that humans are driven by fear and self-interest. Without absolute authority, we destroy each other. Therefore, we need a government so powerful that no one would dare challenge it. Locke looked at a relatively peaceful transfer of power and concluded that humans are basically reasonable. We have rights by nature. We need a limited government to protect those rights, and we can replace it peacefully when it fails us. Rousseau looked at the inequality of his society and concluded that natural humans are good, but civilization has corrupted them. We need a genuine democratic community built on equality and the common good to restore what we have lost. Each of these answers has strengths and weaknesses, and philosophers continue to debate them today. One key challenge to all three is the question of actual consent. Did you ever personally agree to your government? You were born into a country with a government already in place. You did not sign a contract. Locke tried to answer this by arguing that by living in a country and benefiting from its laws, you are giving what he called tacit consent, meaning silent or implied agreement. But critics say this is not good enough. If you are too poor to leave, or if no other country will accept you, you have no real choice. Can you truly be said to have consented to something you had no practical ability to refuse? Another challenge concerns who the contract was really made for. Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau were all writing primarily about men of property. For most of the history of their ideas being used in real governments, women could not vote. Enslaved people had no rights at all, and people without land or wealth were often excluded from the political process. The contract that was supposed to apply to everyone in fact applied mainly to a small group. Feminist thinkers and scholars from historically excluded communities have pointed out that what looked like universal principles were often quite specific protections for a privileged group. Despite these important criticisms, the language of the social contract has not faded. It is alive in every political conversation you will ever hear. When people argue about whether government should have the power to monitor private phone calls in the name of security, that is a Hobbesian debate. How much freedom do we trade for safety? When people argue about whether the government has gone too far and is violating citizens' rights, that is a Lockean debate. Has the contract been broken? When people argue about whether the tax system is fair, whether society should share resources more equally, whether political decisions should reflect the common good rather than the interests of the wealthy, that is a Rousseauian debate. What does the general will demand? These three men, writing in the 17th and 18th centuries, were not just doing abstract philosophy. They were asking questions that every human society must answer. Who has the right to rule? What can rulers do and not do? When must we obey and when do we have the right to resist? What do we owe each other as members of a community? Their answers were different, and none of them was completely right. But together they gave us a vocabulary, a set of ideas and concepts for thinking about these questions with more clarity and precision than before. Every time a person says the government works for the people, they are using Locke. Every time someone says we need strong authority to prevent chaos, they are echoing Hobbes. Every time someone insists that decisions should reflect the common good and not just the wishes of the powerful, they are channeling Rousseau. To summarize what we have covered today, the social contract is a thought experiment and a philosophical argument for why government exists and why it has the right to authority over us. It begins with a state of nature, an imagined world without government, and asks what that world would look like. Thomas Hobbes believed it would be violent and terrifying, and so argued for an all-powerful absolute government that gives security in exchange for obedience. John Locke believed it would be inconvenient but manageable, and argued for a limited government whose only purpose is to protect the natural rights of life, liberty, and property that all people already possess, and which can be replaced if it fails that purpose. Jean-Jacques Rousseau believed natural humans were good and equal, but that private property and corrupt society had destroyed that equality, and so argued for a direct democracy guided by the general will of the whole community. All three thinkers left a lasting mark on real governments and real revolutions. Their debates about the nature of freedom, the limits of government, and the rights of individuals remain at the center of political life to this day.